Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. NYU election law professor Samuel Issacharoff spoke at the Yale Law School on March 4, 2010. Professor Issacharoff lectured about the future of campaign finance reform after the Supreme Court's groundbreaking decision in Citizens United. His talk was sponsored by the American Constitution Society at Yale Law School.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here. Owen Fist was my teacher in a course on First Amendment nearly 30 years ago now, and that was the first place I ever read Buckley v. Valeo. And had my life gone in better directions, it would have been the last place I'd read it also. And I take it that you've all read this, which is Citizens United, which I have to edit down for the supplement this summer. So 160 years ago, the Supreme Court handed down one of its most famous or infamous opinions, Dred Scott. And in Dred Scott, the court ultimately held that a black person who had been a slave could not invoke the concept of personhood under the Constitution in order to claim constitutional protections. Terrible decision, lives on in infamy. And 160 years later, the Supreme Court decides that by contrast, a corporation is a person, and not only does it have personhood for purposes of things like jurisdiction and citizenship, but it also is entitled to robustly claim the protections of the First Amendment. And so I'd like to begin with the claim that's never quite stated this way, but it's implicit, that this is a catastrophic decision, Citizens United, on the order of Dred Scott. If you were to read my colleague Ronnie Dworkin in the New York Review of Books or the editorial pages of the New York Times, this is perhaps the most drastic decision of the Supreme Court since Bush versus Gore, and in terms of its recognition of fundamental inequalities in our society, probably in a very long time. And if you want to be hyperbolic enough, you could take this all the way back to Dred Scott. So I want to make a few points this afternoon. And I want to say that these arguments are dramatically overstated, that while Citizens United is a significant opinion for reasons I will get into, its likely social effect will be modest, and that's a prediction, which is the area where you are most likely to be wrong, because it is not a matter of doctrinal analysis, but predicting what institutional arrangements will emerge. And I want to also suggest that some of the criticisms of it are simply wrong. And so let me start there. One of the arguments that's made against Citizens United, and this was by way of Justice Stevens' full-throated denunciation of the majority opinion, one of the arguments that's made about Citizens United was that it radically reached out and overturned unsettled law, that there had been precedent on point, most notably the case of Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and that the court went out of its way to reach issues that it should not have reached. So let me start there. The law in this area is defined for the past 35 years by Buckley versus Valeo. Now, Buckley versus Valeo decided that it had to mediate the fundamental tension in post-war American constitutional law, the tension between equality and liberty. And these are the two great constitutional traditions that have emerged in the United States in the past half century or 75 years. And the basic idea is that when we look at the political process, the animating spirit should be equality. Right, that's the notion of one person, one vote that we get from Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims, the reapportionment cases of the 1960s. And if you look at the language of Reynolds versus Sims, the constitutional guarantee, according to Chief Justice Warren, was that every citizen should be entitled to what the court called an equally effective voice in the political process. Now, clearly, You cannot have equally effective voices in a system that is responsive to money if the citizens don't have equal access to money. And so since we have dramatic income differences or wealth differences in our population, seemingly the command of equality that comes from the reapportionment cases must condemn a system that is based upon private finance, where wealthier individuals have greater access to influence in the political process. But we also have the other side, which is the liberty side, which is a strong First Amendment condemnation of governmental efforts to regulate the terms of political discourse. And so these two come into conflict in the domain of campaign finance. And Buckley versus Valeo tried to mediate this divide by saying that where there is the risk of corruption, and this was the key animating principle in Buckley, where there is the risk of corruption, the government can regulate, because then you get all sorts of distortions, potential illegal conduct, and it's basically a prophylactic rule. So the idea in Buckley versus Valeo was where there is the prospect or even the perception of corruption, you can regulate. And that takes place when I take money out of my pocket and give it to a candidate. And so that's the contribution side of the debate. And on the other hand, where I am taking money from my own pocket to express my views, however it got there, assuming it got there legally, then at that point, it's just a matter of free expression. And so the divide in Buckley was that the state can regulate contributions, it cannot regulate expenditures, and one is First Amendment protected as speech pure, more or less, and the other one is subject to a fairly tolerant level of regulation, so long as it's content neutral, viewpoint neutral, meets all the other standard First Amendment criteria. Now, this was the law of Buckley versus Valeo, and two things happened. The first is that the contributions expenditures line broke down. Because what does it mean to give money to a candidate? What happens when you take out ads with your own money? You speak, but you speak in support of a candidate. Is it coordinated? Even if it's uncoordinated, is there not some kind of reciprocity relationship that develops? And a whole series of cases tested that line and found it wanting. But the second thing that was more important is that over time, the court began to reject the Buckley v. Valeo divide. And so over the past 15 years, in a series of cases, between 5 and 7 members of the justices of the Supreme Court have rejected Buckley v. Valeo in case after case after case. In other words, there has not been a case in the U.S. Supreme Court in 15 years in which a majority of the justices have endorsed Buckley v. Valeo. Now, the reason it stands is that half of them believe that the contributions are also First Amendment protected, and half of them believe that the expenditures are subject to regulation as well. So you have a constitutional principle, Buckley v. Valeo, that stands only as a historical artifact. It stands only because it can't fall in either direction yet. Now, the one exception in this whole area of law is Austin versus Chamber of Commerce, Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And that's the case that was overruled in Citizens United. Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce said, we're going to redefine corruption in two significant ways. Corruption is defined, first of all, by the distortion in the outcomes of the political process, distortion created by some people being able to speak more than others, in other words, having more money, and that's a form of corruption. That's a radical argument in favor of equal expenditures by all the citizens, or strong limitations, or perhaps in a different regulatory environment in support of public finance. That's fine as a principle. We can argue, we can agree, disagree, but it is completely, in my view, inconsistent with Buckley v. Valeo and with a series of other cases the court decided, most notably the Bellotti case out of Massachusetts, for those that know this area. The second thing about Austin was that it found the locus of the corruption in a different place than did the whole Buckley v. Valeo line of cases. Buckley v. Valeo is always about, at some level, a quid pro quo. Not exactly, I'm going to give you $10, you give me $10 worth of government contracts, but the sense that you're going to be obligated to me and you're going to do right by me. That's the quid pro quo. In Austin, the group that was corrupted was not the elected officials, but us, the voters. And so there was a sense that we would be hapless as voters, as the Democratic polity, in having to address the distortions created by the influence of money. So that's the doctrinal background. So along comes Citizens United, and Citizens United should have been a nothing case. You have a fringe group. They're really marginal. They want to put out this diatribe, Hillary the movie. It's clearly political speech. All it is an attack on Hillary Clinton that says she shouldn't be president of the United States. They want to put it out in conjunction with the election, but they want to broadcast it, and so they need to raise some money, and they get a little bit of corporate money. And that puts them, that makes them outside, that puts them outside the formal regulatory structures of the McCain-Feingold bill, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, or BCRA. And so it could have gone away. It should have gone away. The Federal Elections Commission should have said, this is de minimis amount of contributions, or it could have said, this is being put on video on demand. Right? They didn't even have money to broadcast this thing. So you could have said, that's not really a broadcast, that McCain-Feingold is worried about you forcibly entering into someone's living room with an ad that you paid for, and this is not that kind of forcible entry. This is pulling, not pushing. And therefore, because it's video on demand, it's like, you know, non-broadcast activity outside the ad. And so it went up on a bunch of technical issues under the statute. During the course of the argument, the first time it was argued, the court started pushing Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart, who was arguing for the government, and said, well, how far does this regulatory interest go? What happens if Citizens United was not putting out a video, but was putting out a book? And what could the government expand McCain-Feingold? Could it expand the ambit of the statute to ban a book? Right? And Stewart, quite boldly, answered, yes, of course. And at that point, everything broke down. Because the answer was no, and my time is up. And I'm sorry I can't stick around. This is the third rail of the First Amendment, the idea of the government banning books. We all have the image of the Nazi bonfires, and this was the one thing that could not be allowed. So at that point, the court basically shut down, ordered rehearing, and this fall, last fall, Elena Kagan made her first argument as Solicitor General in this case. So she did a couple of things. She said, first of all, that we abandoned this line about banning books. Clearly, you could not do that, which then invited the question, why videos and not books? And the answer was unavailing. Because there is no principled line there. And Malcolm Stewart was entirely right. If the power extends, it extends. And so you have to live with the consequences. The second thing she did was she decided that the distortion argument of Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which the court had accepted from Paul Clement when he was Solicitor General arguing on behalf of the initial challenge to the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold, that this distortion argument would not stand up. And so she said, what this is really about is a form of shareholder protection. This is the compelling governmental interest. Now, there is a risk to anybody who argues cases where when you make a pretextual argument. And this statute was not passed to protect shareholder wealth. There, you would search in vain in the legislative history, and it's a long one, for the idea that what's really animating Congress is shareholder wealth distortions. And then she gets beaten up. Why? Because if you're concerned about shareholder wealth, why are you limiting this to expenditures made within 30 or 60 days of an election? Doesn't shareholder dissipation, shareholder wealth dissipation, occur 90 days, 120 days before Right? So this is not a particularly strong argument. And so what should have been a small case, all of a sudden, all the statutory arguments dropped away and the court engaged the core issues. Now, what did it do? Well, this is the notorious part. It declared that the corporations have the First Amendment rights. And it did so, and this is what the part of the opinion that I find the most troubling personally, it did so in an extravagant way. There is a divide in the First Amendment case law. And there are two competing strains in these cases. And if you go back to the iconic cases like New York Times versus Sullivan, you see it present even in Justice Brennan's opinion from the Sullivan case. So for example, New York Times versus Sullivan, which is a case about whether there's protection against defamation laws under the First Amendment for the institutionalized press, runs two different arguments that both point in the same direction, but won't both carry to the same extent. One argument is that the New York Times has a categorical First Amendment right, that it's a rights-bearing entity, and that the First Amendment vests it with a right that cannot be violated by local defamation prosecutions during the civil rights era. That's one approach, and that, if you read the New York Times, that is the approach that they like, right? The absolute guarantee of a right to this entity. The second approach is present in Brennan and present throughout the First Amendment cases and was most strongly argued back when I was a law student by another professor of mine, Robert Bork, as the thesis of the First Amendment, is that it's a guarantee of the institutional conditions necessary for democracy. And so it becomes a prohibitory or expressive limitation on the powers of the state rather than a vesting of absolute rights in the citizenry. And in most cases, the two run together and there's not a great deal of tension. But one of the interesting things about Citizens United is that the court could have done all the work of striking down this particular legislation had it simply said, we find that the government doesn't have a sufficiently compelling interest. After all, General Kagan had given away the distortion argument. The government did not have a strong statutory purpose that it could point to that was defended in any way on its face, right? Or perhaps even as particularly as applied. It could have handled this as an as-applied challenge. Although it's a peculiar case because it's technically an on-its-face as-applied challenge. Right, the posture of the case is actually, at very rarefied levels of constitutional review, kind of an odd one. It could have done that. Instead, Justice Kennedy went out of his way to talk about the rights-bearing quality of the corporation, which then prompted the Scalia concurrence, in which Justice Scalia goes even further and says that the history of the United States is the history of the creation of the corporate charter. Basically, and you know, it's got something to it, I suppose. It's not the way I learned it in grade school, but you know, but maybe now we all will. Okay, so that's the first part. Now, here's the odd part of the case. The odd part of the case is, where were the corporations in this case? Tons of amicus briefs filed. Not a single American corporation filed an amicus brief. Chamber of Commerce filed one saying that there should be, you know, big time First Amendment protections, and certainly they get their money from corporations, but there's always an agency issue between the principals who are the corporations and their more ideological representatives. There is in all matters. Why didn't the corporations come in there? Why wasn't GM or Exxon or Google or somebody in there arguing for the First Amendment rights of the corporations? Well, it turns out that corporations don't seem to much want to participate in election campaigns for the most part. And so how do we know this? Well, there in about half the states in the United States, it is lawful for corporations to contribute and for unions to contribute to election campaigns. And what do the data indicate on this? Well, let's take California. Somebody did a study between 2001 and 2006 in California. you look at the top 10 contributors to elections in that period, what do you find? There are two wealthy individuals, not corporations, wealthy individuals on the top 10 who contributed in one election because a friend of theirs was running for governor, and so they gave a whole bunch of money. Other than that, the other seven of the top 10, leaving aside these two individuals, are who? Whom? Either labor unions or Indian tribes. Number 10 is the trial lawyers, the plaintiff's bar. There is not a single corporation in this the top of this list. There's not a single corporation near the top of the list. That's funny. Where's the, you know, there you've liberalized it. Oh my God, the corporation's going to come in. They're going to spend all this money on campaigns. They don't do it. How come? Well, it turns out that corporations don't like to spend money in campaigns. So a study done by Gary Jacobson, a political scientist at the University of California, San Diego, who's the best person on the data involved in election politics in the United States, indicates that the only corporations that actually participate in campaign contributions are either the small ideological corporations, and we know them from the case law, Michigan's Massachusetts Citizens for Life, or Wisconsin Right to Life Corporation, things of that sort, or family corporations, that is, closed proprietorships, basically. Now, by family corporations, we also have to expand the category a little bit to corporations dominated by the founding family. So that brings in Walmart, right? So it's cheating a little bit on the definition, but what you don't find is the major diversified, long-standing, publicly held corporations participating. And I want to suggest that there's three reasons for this. The first reason is that they basically don't want to come into elections where they're going to possibly polarize part of their consuming public. Right, so that if you support the Democrats, you're going to piss off the Republicans and vice versa. But more than that, most publicly held corporations don't want to be involved in the issues upon which we run our elections in this country. They don't want to take a position on abortion. They don't want to take a position on three strikes, you're out. They don't want to take a position on so many of these types of issues. The second one is a less charitable view of corporations. Corporations have discovered a very good way to get exactly what they want out of our government, and that's through lobbying. That's through other kinds of targeted contributions to people in power. That's by hiring them when they leave office and dangling the prospect that they will be hired while they're in office. Just want to make sure I don't talk too long. And it turns out this is remarkably effective. What's ineffective is to donate to campaigns, because when you donate to campaigns, it's a noisy signal. When you come in and lobby and you start throwing blandishments around and you start contributing to the private charities of individual members of Congress, some of you may have seen the expose in the Times on some of the private charities of the Congressional Black Caucus done 2 weeks ago. Elections are noisy by comparison. They're a bad way to try to get what you want out of government. People who think you get what you want out of government are foolish, naive, hopeless citizens like us. People who have money, who really know how things work, that's the last thing you want to be involved in, right? And then there's the flip side of that, and is that, and that's the third point, is that corporations have both a collective action problem and a big problem of coordination that they can't readily overcome. So how does this play out? First of all, when corporations start spending too much time together, saying we got to raise money to do this, to get this reform, that reform, things like that, it starts looking like they're getting together, right? And there happen to be criminal prohibitions on this, and right? So many of you will make your very good livings off the fact that corporations violate these laws routinely, but they know that they're not supposed to. right? That they know that they're not supposed to engage in collusive behavior over the structure of government. Now, there's exceptions. We have Norm Pennington. You're allowed to get together in order to lobby the government. But it's a very fine line. They do not have the culture of collective action. And this plays out in the political arena. So let me give you an example. Just over a month ago, there was an election in the state of Oregon. Oregon allows contributions from corporations into its public events. So the Oregon legislature had passed a budget which spent quite lavishly on public services, and as a result was $770 million in the red. And Oregon, like many states, has a balanced budget requirement for its under its state constitution. So it had to either cut back $770 million or raise $770 million. So there was an initiative. This is the West, where they do things through this time-tested manner. I was in California recently giving a talk, and people were complaining about the initiative. I said, how else would you get really high level of services and no taxes except through the initiative, right? It works great. In Oregon, there were focus groups, and it was tested how can we get people to vote for $770 million, and it was found that you raise taxes on people who make more than $200,000 or whatever it is. That's fine. That's just classic redistribution. That's what the tax system does. The other part was, let's impose a payroll tax on all employers. And the employers went bonkers. They said, we have over 10% unemployment in this state. We are one of the most regulated states in the country. We're not competitive. This is going to kill us in our competition with other employers in other states. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. And what did they do? They actually got together, and they raised money from businesses, largely from corporations, to try to defeat this referendum. They went into the public arena against the public employee unions, and they got walloped. They got walloped because they got outspent 2-1 by the public employee unions. Why? Because they have concentrated, coordinated interests. It's exactly what public choice would dictate, right? Public choice theory. And the corporations, why should I give when my competitor might not give, right? They don't have a coordination mechanism, so they have the constant problem of free riding, and they just did not get it done. So my view is that this idea that the corporations have just been waiting to get in and give a lot of money in campaigns is quite naive, and that a lot of the hoopla over Citizens United is based on a quite strongly held political attachment to the ideal of equality, and the people who are most strongly attached to it find this deeply offensive, even if the practical outcomes are not going to be that great. Now, let me make two final points about this, and then I'll stop and take questions. The first is, if you're concerned about this, what should be done, right? And then the second one is going to be, what should you be concerned about? If you are concerned, if you don't like this, what should be done? Well, one of the proposals that's up in Congress right now is we need more shareholder protection. We need we have to protect against corporations not having a narrow short-term economic focus and using shareholder resources for things that are not directed toward immediate returns to the shareholder. Okay, big policy question. Do we really want to narrow the horizon, the time horizon, and the social mission of our corporations? That's a policy debate. I would happen to be on the side that it's already too constricted, but be that as it may. If that's what we're worried about, there is no evidence that the corporations are violating some kind of fiduciary duty in any significant way in the political arena. As I said, the evidence is that it's either closely held or closely controlled corporations they had the normal mechanisms of corporate approval, of shareholder approval, would get this through anyway without any problem. But if we're really worried about shareholders' money being used for things that are not directly tied to the corporation's immediate economic interests, then we really have to start rethinking our society. We have to start shutting down our symphony halls, having no more baseball fields, probably shutting down a bunch of research universities, because Let's face it, that's where a lot of our institutions get their money, our major institutions. So I'm not very much persuaded by that as an objective, and I think that that's make weight. And I think that it constitutionally will probably run into the same problems that Elena Kagan had in the Supreme Court. I think there's a much more serious issue. And that is, it goes back to an argument that's really old, also from this school, from two professors who were here when I was a student, were the main exponents of it, and that's Harry Wellington and Ralph Winter. And they used to argue about why public employees should not be allowed to strike. And they put forward the thesis that there should not be a group of individuals. They didn't have all the public choice language at the time, but there should not be groups of individuals with closely held, tightly bound interests who can act both as participants in the political process and as an extra political arena, that is, outside the political arena, force trying to extract things from government. Now, take the Wellington-Winter hypothesis and move it into contemporary society. I think what our real concern should be is not campaign contributions as such by corporations generally, but targeted self-interest by those who contract with the government. Because as the size of government expands, what we have is a risk that the government becomes more and more a situs for rent seeking. And one could have a broader argument about whether that's behind a lot of the dysfunction of our politics. If the government becomes a situs for rent seeking, then you're going to have people who are incentivized, or institutions, or corporations, or unions, who are incentivized to use the political process in aid of rent seeking. If that were the source of our concern, not the distortion in the outcome of the elections, but the distortion in the policies of the government, which I think is really what's at issue here, then you should look to a different kind of model, not shareholder protection, but the Hatch Act. And the Hatch Act is a prohibition on contributions and various kinds of political activity by public employees. Right? And why is it a prohibition? One is the kind of Wellington Winter idea that there's too much interest here. But the other part is where really the corporations are concerned. And the other part is most corporations don't want to give. Most corporations like limitations on corporate contributions to candidates because it means the candidates can't shake them down. And if you talk to corporate officials, this is what they're concerned about. They're concerned about the shakedown because every corporation does business with the government. And now all of a sudden the people who are going to be in charge at the local level, at the national level, come to you and say, we'd like $25,000 into our coffers, please, or don't come to us in 6 months. Well, in 6 months, all of a sudden, these are the folks that are giving out a lot of public resources. And I think that our bigger concern should be the tie-in between contributions as an extortionate matter and the obligation of government officials to then use governmental power to reward their new stakeholders, if you will. Final point. In much of my writing in this area, I've expressed skepticism about campaign finance reform, its objectives. Unless we're going to have public funding, which is a whole separate set of issues, money has to be raised privately. And the question is, where do you want the money to go? Now, there are folks, like my colleague Ronald Dworkin, who don't want the money to go, who think that the money in the politics is essentially evil, and who have this equalizing notion that we should drive down the amount of money. I think that that's unrealistic. I think that what we should aim for is to make the money accountable in a way. And the only way you make money accountable is when it's given to candidates and parties. And one of the terrible things of many of the campaign finance reforms, and BCRA actually cured this to a certain extent, was that they pushed money away from candidates and parties and to tertiary organizations, the 527 groups, all the various institutional actors who come in, usually around a single set of issues, and have extreme polar positions and do not have to try to build coalitions that can then be translated into governance. And those institutional actors are the ones who benefit when candidates and parties don't get money. One of the great things about BCRA was that it raised the amount of hard money, and what's called hard money, that is money that the candidates and parties could collect legally, dramatically, which meant that Barack Obama could raise $800 million in his presidential campaign, which meant he drove the message of his campaign, unlike John Kerry, who had to let George Soros drive the message because Kerry didn't have money. And so right now, the technical state of the law is the corporations and unions presumably are now free to spend money so long as they don't give it to candidates and parties. So they can come in and now start poisoning or pushing the polls of the debate when they choose to get involved and don't have to actually filter it through a candidate that has to run for office. So I actually think that the resolution is probably the worst of all worlds as it stands right after Citizens United. It's unlikely the law is going to settle at this point, though. This is just the first, the opening gambit in this issue. Okay, I'll take questions.